If you listen closely, you may notice that Mishki takes great license with some of the details surrounding the news of the day. Listen at your own amusement. Thank you.
Gentlemen, KSTP now presents the Mishki Broadcast, featuring the broadcast outcast, transmitting live from his renegade radio outpost here in the final 90 feet in the city of St. Paul.
Good evening, folks. Mishki here with you on a cold November evening. The 40th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination has passed. It passed approximately 55 hours ago. There will be little talk of JFK's death for another 5 years, maybe 10 years. We'll wait for another anniversary. That's just the way we operate in this country. In the days leading up to the 40th anniversary, many media outlets took their crack at the assassination. I'm sure you checked out one or more. They gave their take. They offered their theory. They pushed their view. And I want to pass along something here related to this. I have a new worry to go with my old worry. The old worry was that the people behind Kennedy's death would get away with it. That was the old worry. The new worry is that America is going to shift from a nation sure of a conspiracy to a nation buying the Warren Commission report, the lone gunman theory, the Lee Harvey Oswald alone from the sixth floor theory. Respectable media institutions have been selling this past week, and it both worries and baffles me. And I've waited till now because I wanted to get past this whole 40th anniversary and have time to digest what was pitched to the country. And I'm not optimistic based on the gullibility of Americans and what I saw thrown at them. I'm not optimistic that my new worries aren't valid or that they won't become more than just worries, but facts that one day we, in fact, will just be a country with a majority buying the Warren Commission report. And what astonishes me is there is no more sound belief in America today. No more sound belief in America today than the belief that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone and fire 3 shots at JFK from the book depository, killing him. The only reasonable view in America today, and I mean this, is that something more went on here. That's the only reasonable view. Now, once you get past something more went on here, then there are reasonable takes and unreasonable takes. But the most sound belief in America today is that something more went on here. Something more went on here. If you have not studied this case, you may believe Oswald killed Kennedy firing from a sixth-floor window and did it alone. If you have studied this case and pushed that theory, I don't trust you. And by that I mean I don't trust your motives. I don't know what you're doing or why, but you have ulterior motives in my mind for your belief. Of that I'm convinced. If you've studied this and believe Oswald acted alone, fired 3 shots from the book depository, if you've really studied it, then I think there's another reason behind your wanting to believe that. And I'm convinced that the media outlets that have pushed this lone gunman business over the last week are even scarier because they have ulterior motives as well, but they have power to go with those motives. So I need to know what's going on in this country, because I have to tell you, a jury acquitted O.J. Simpson, and a lot of America, most of America, stood in shock, saying, has any case been more obvious? Yet the Kennedy assassination is a more obvious case of conspiracy by a long shot than the O.J. case is of proving his guilt. So as much as you would question someone sitting beside you convinced O.J. Simpson had nothing to do with the death of his ex-wife, I'm that much more wanting to question tonight anyone who thinks Oswald shot Kennedy from a window and did so alone. And if you think this, would you do me a favor and get on the line now? If you believe this, would you call me? I'm quite serious, because we can actually accomplish some things tonight and not just have a diatribe, but actually accomplish some things that are critical, I think, to this country. 646-TALK is the number, 646-8255, or long distance, 877-615-1500. Why do I care? Because the killing of President Kennedy was the American crime of the century. Wasn't the crime of the century on the planet. You can look to the acts of Hitler and Stalin for that. But in America, in terms of an unsolved crime, nothing compares. In the 20th century, that's the crime, and it's unsolved. In 2003, we still have not caught and prosecuted the perpetrators, some of whom are alive still. That should eat at you. It should be troubling to you if that doesn't eat at you. As an American, as a human being with any belief in the importance of justice, if spirits don't rest when murders go unsolved, JFK's spirit is one seriously restless spirit. And one day, as a nation, we ought to change that. But what troubles me after the past week is there are forces out there fighting this, and I want to know why. I want to know why, Peter Jennings. I want to know why, Dan Rather. What the hell has you guys abdicating all your journalism training, your skeptical instincts, your questioning spirit, your curious soul? What's going on in a country where the obvious is being overlooked, forsaken, in place of a really difficult, twisted tap dance through all sorts of hoops known as the Oswald alone from the sixth floor approach, or the magic bullet theory, or the Warren Report? A convoluted stretching in every single way to cover asses and plug holes and make things work that don't work. And this past weekend and this past week, a disservice was done to this country by many media outlets. What's their reason for obstructing justice, for hiding the truth? What? Because nothing short of that has gone on, and I would be delighted if you care to argue with that. Just thrilled, and would invite you now to call 646-8255 in St. Paul, or long distance 877-615-1500. To help me tonight, someone who has done quite a bit to further the truth in this assassination and the search for the truth, and someone who is a tireless researcher in this area. He's from the University of Minnesota Duluth. We're very lucky to have him here. I want to welcome him now. Will you bring up James Fetzer for me?
I'm right here, Tom.
There you are. Professor Fetzer, thank you so much for being with me on short notice. You've been a busy man over the last week, and even more than that, I'm sure. Professor Fetzer has been researching this topic and delving into all the angles, all the corners, all the theories for so long now. I think I first had him on 8 years ago on the show, spoke with him for 2 hours, haven't had him on here since, but have certainly heard him many other places. Jesse Ventura's show just this past weekend, MSNBC heard him on the National Coast to Coast program, which runs on this station. Last week he was on with George Norrie. And many others. In fact, I think he's been on but somewhere between 250 and 300 different media outlets over the years at, on this topic. And there's really there may be people who equal you in knowledge nationally on this assassination, but none who top you. And I want to have you on because there are two things bothering me. One is I've had people coming up to me in the past week who have said, knowing my interest in this, who have said, you know, that ABC special really solidified in my mind this whole one gunman theory, or someone who catches some other. I don't have cable at home, and I don't know what all ran, but there was a lot out there. I know that the History Channel did a good job on something they did, but there were also some other media outlets who were doing things that seemed to at least allow people to conclude, boy, maybe that whole Warren Commission thing was dead on. And it got to the point today where, I don't know, it hit a critical mass, one too many people mentioning this to me, and I said, you know, we're going the wrong way in this country. We're going the wrong direction. A, with what used to be an 80% of the population being convinced of a conspiracy down to 70%, and I would argue after this past week of propaganda, we may be down another 10%. It may be down to 60% believing in a conspiracy. And I need to know why that's happening. And what the motivations are behind people pushing it, because as I said, Professor Fetzer, the most sound belief in America today is that something more went on. If you want to take it from there and start talking what more went on, you can get into different areas of credibility. But the most sound argument in America today, I think, is that something more went on. And there are so many facts that prove this, that I'm stuck wondering, what the hell is Peter Jennings' story? What is with him? Why would he be a part of something, this fraud, that was this ABC special last week? Your take on it, just to start out, Professor.
Well, Tom, I think it's admirable that you're focusing on this issue because it has disturbed me profoundly to see major media outlets such as ABC abused in this fashion, apparently with the complicity of the president of ABC News, David Weston, and then Peter Jennings himself. It's quite shocking. When I first learned that this was going to take place, I sent both of them, all three of my, namely Assassination Science, Murder in Dealey Plaza, and the Great Zapruder film hoax, in the hope that they might actually read even just the preface and the prologue to realize how grossly mistaken and what misconceptions they were laboring under if they thought that their production, This animation, this cartoon, was going to do anything at all to edify or illuminate what happened to John F. Kennedy in Dealey Plaza. It was shocking to me, Tom, and there are so many reasons why this was a travesty. I mean, the production was built upon three faulty premises. One, that the magic bullet theory, the idea that a single bullet entered at the base of the back of the neck, traversed the president's neck without hitting any bony structures, exited at the front of his neck at the level of his tie, entered John Connolly's back near to the armpit, exited below his right nipple, hit his right wrist, wound up in his left thigh. That's one premise that is demonstrably false. It also assumes that Lee Oswald was, in fact, the lone assassin, that he was even in the sixth floor, that his Manlicher Carcano could have fired the bullets, that he wasn't framed using phony evidence. That is demonstrably provable to be false. And in the third place, it assumes the authenticity of the Zapruder film, that they actually had a timeline without which they couldn't have offered the reconstruction. I mean, if you just stop and ponder, there's a very important consideration here, namely that in order to perform the reconstruction, to make the calculations they allegedly performed, they would have to know the exact position of the limousine at the time the shots were fired. They'd have to know the exact position of the president's body at the time he was impacted with those shots. And they'd have to know the exact trajectories based upon a detailed analysis of the wounds.
This whole ABC thing was based on some guy's computer model of... It all happened in this abstract computer world, when they presented it on ABC, they said, here's how it all was. And it looked all nice and official. It was happening with all these nice lines, and it looked like they had this 3D computer imagery. And I thought, but it didn't happen on a computer. It happened in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas. You're showing us a cartoon.
You're absolutely right, Tom. There's an old axiom in computer science, G-I-G-O, garbage in, garbage out. Any computer model is dependent upon assumptions and data. In this case, they made false assumptions, and they had essentially non-existent data. For example, in relation to the wounds, if an exact enough description of the wounds does not occur in the autopsy report, then they had no foundation for the reconstruction at all. And I can assure you, having published the autopsy report as an appendix in Assassination Science, having studied it in considerable detail, they did not have the data they had to have in order to perform a reconstruction of the kind they claimed to have done using that computer. And it's much worse than that, Tom. Two shots were widely reported on radio and television the day of the assassination. One was a shot to the throat that was fired from in front. In fact, it actually passed through the windshield of the limousine. The other was a shot to the right temple that was a frangible or exploding bullet that blew out the president's brains. He'd already been hit in the back of the head. His cranium had been weakened. And this bullet exploded with such force that his brains were blown out so hard that a motorcycle patrolman to the left rear thought he himself had been shot. The next day, a medical student named Billy Harper found a large triangular chunk of the president's skull on the grass, took it to a relative at Methodist Hospital, who photographed it, which is a good thing, because once it was turned over to the FBI, like other important evidence in this case, it simply disappeared. So where is the reconstruction for those wounds?
Right. Whenever I deal with this assassination, and I always try to get as close to that day and that place in Texas as I can, because the further you get away from that day, the more you allow people the ability to play with facts and play with evidence and play with the truth. But if you stay with that day, and you just, sometimes I think what gets lost in the Kennedy assassination is just some common horse sense of just imagining yourself there, and you hear these shots, which for the people who were there is more than the number that was officially reported. When you talk to people who happen to be there in Dealey Plaza, you hear about more than three shots. And then, of course, the comeback is, well, it was echoing around, and you heard echoes. And then you see people running up to the grassy knoll, and you talk about people who saw a puff of smoke there, and you see a cop running up there with his gun drawn. And again, generally when shots are fired, especially multiple shots, you get a sense of where they're coming from, and people going in that direction should mean something. So you see people running toward an area in front of the car, more than one person, a cop who certainly is trained in this area, doing the same. And you say, oh, it looks like some shots might have come from there. And you get to the hospital, and you have professional doctors who've seen bullet wounds before, and they say, yeah, that's an obvious entrance wound there in the neck. We've seen that before, and that's an entrance wound there in the head. And the story is consistent and logical, and it makes sense. And it's only when you leave Dealey Plaza and you get away and you start getting involved in what the FBI are pitching, or what people LBJ has hired are pitching, that stuff starts to get messed with. And pretty soon it starts to get ugly. And eventually it gets real ugly. But if you just kind of hover around the day and the place, It isn't a bizarre story with 50 different tales coming from 50 different directions. It's a fairly consistent story. Someone runs into Lee Harvey Oswald at 25 after 12 on the first floor. Kennedy is killed 4 minutes later. How would a guy who's not even a professional hitman be so calm as to think, I don't think the car is coming for a couple minutes, I'll scoot up to the sixth floor and kill him in a little bit? and then afterwards, suddenly he's how long after the assassination is he discovered on a second floor, Professor?
90 seconds.
90 seconds. And there he is, 90 seconds. He shot him and has bolted down to the second floor. He's just kind of relaxing, having a Coke and not even panting. I mean, again, if you stay with the day, it really should take you in any direction other than, Lee Harvey Oswald all alone shooting from a sixth floor. And that's where I think you have to start, because once you leave the day, anything can happen. You play with it, you can play with evidence, you can change stories, you can get to people, people can change their stories. But boy, do things seem consistent for the first few hours after 12:29, 12:30 on November 2nd, 22nd, 1963. It seems consistent there for a while before everything goes haywire. The guy, the ambulance driver, taking Kennedy from Parkland Hospital to the airport, feels the back of his head, feels that the head's gone, the back of the head, the skull is blown out, which could only happen from a frontal shot. Just average human beings saying what they saw and heard tells a story in itself, in a legitimate, logical story of how a president would be assassinated. And then something happens after that. Something goes crazy, and it's been going crazy ever since for 40 years.
Tom, you're absolutely right. I mean, if for example, when the Warren Commission deposed the physicians from Parkland and just asked them what they had seen, you would have a virtually complete unanimity that there was a small round hole to the throat that was obviously a wound of entry, and a massive blowout to the back of the head that was obviously a wound of exit. And several would have reported that there was an entry wound to the right temple. In fact, even Malcolm Kilduff at 1:30, when he announced the death of the president, said it was a simple matter of a bullet right through the head while pointing to his right temple, and attributing that finding to Admiral George Berkeley, the president's personal physician. The Malcolm Perry, MD, who performed the tracheostomy on the president, he made a small incision straight through the wound to the throat in a vain attempt to save him. And Kemp Clark, who is the director of neurosurgery, appeared at a press conference that began at 3:16 that afternoon. Malcolm Perry, three different times, reported that this wound to the throat was a wound of entry. When a reporter asked, was the bullet coming at him, Perry affirmed it was coming at him. Now, there was really no question about it. And as I have already observed, reports widely broadcast on radio and television reported precisely these two wounds, the wound to the throat and the wound to the temple, both of which were fired from in front. So what happens when Arlen Specter deposes these physicians? He doesn't ask them what they saw. He doesn't ask them to draw what they saw. He doesn't ask them if there was a blowout to the back of the head. Rather, he says, he asks them to assume certain hypotheses. He says, if we assume that a bullet entered here at the base of the back of the neck, while identifying a point that is above the shoulder and low on the neck, but clearly on the neck, and that it passed through the neck without hitting any bony structures, and that it came out here indicating the front of his neck, would that be consistent with saying that this wound to the front of the neck was a wound of exit? And of course, they would reply, as did Malcolm Perry, why, yes, that would be consistent with those assumptions, but that he was not in a position to vouch for or verify the assumptions he'd been asked to make. And, Tom, you can see how ludicrous it is. Rather than trying to elicit information that would reveal what happens, he used a duplicitous hypothetical question to conceal information. And we not only know that the wound was not in the back of the neck where he assumed it had hit, but 5.5 inches lower. It was a shallow shot, only went in about as far as the second knuckle on your little finger. We know that from the shirt. We know that from the jacket. We know that from an autopsy diagram. We know it from a second by one of the pathologists. We know it from a second autopsy diagram by an FBI agent. We know it from the president's personal physician's death certificate. We even know that the Warren Commission took it to be the case because we have reenactment photographs showing stand-ins for Jack Kennedy with a large circular patch about 5.5 inches below the collar, below the shoulder. And I know my favorite photograph here is one of Arlen Specter with a pointer demonstrating the trajectory the magic bullet would have to have taken if that hypothesis were true. And you can see below his hand about 4 inches this large circular patch on the back, which means that a photograph intended to illustrate the magic bullet actually refutes it. And as though that weren't enough, Tom, when the Assassination Records Review Board began declassifying documents and records after it had been created in the wake of the tremendous interest generated by Oliver Stone's film JFK by an act of Congress, one of the very first documents it declassified revealed that Gerald Ford, then a member of the commission, had had the description of the wound to the back changed from the uppermost back, which was already an exaggeration, to the base of the back of the neck. Since otherwise, the magic bullet theory doesn't get off the ground.
Right. I want to take a call here because I have asked a couple of people, I've asked anybody out there, but a couple of people are on hold. If you watched some of what was pitched over the last week and it has you puzzled or it has you thinking, this is a pretty sound case, this Oswald Alone deal, because what has to be done is people who bought what was pitched in the last week, I think, need to bring their concerns to somebody like James Fetzer, who's looked at all this and can give you another view. Now, right now I want to go to a guy who's on hold, John. John, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. Go ahead. You saw the ABC?
Yeah, both the ABC and the Frontline.
Frontline was the other one. And you said while ABC pushed the Oswald Alone from the sixth floor theory, Frontline, while it didn't push one theory or another, it seemed to lean towards the lone gunman idea.
Yeah, I would say even more than lean. It said make your own conclusion, but from what they presented, you'd have to conclude a single assassin.
Well, John, did they explain, for example, that the Mannlicher Carcano was a piece of junk, that it, with a muzzle velocity of 2,000 feet per second, it wasn't even a high-velocity weapon, and yet the description of the death certificate and the Warren report and books written about it have all concluded that Jack was killed by high-velocity bullets, in which case he cannot have been killed by Mannlicher or Carcano. Did they explain that Oswald was a terrible shot? I'm a former Marine Corps officer. I used to supervise recruit training at the same marksmanship range, Edson Range, and the same recruit depot in San Diego where he took his training. And I can assure you he was never trained to use a bolt-action rifle. He was never trained to fire with a telescope. He was never trained to shoot down from a building at a moving target.
No, they presented him as an excellent shot.
Yeah, well, that's completely ludicrous. In 1957, he fired .212, which is reasonably good, but that was done under intense recruit training, and that's when most Marines performed the very best. The next year, he didn't qualify at all, which is stunning, because every Marine is required to qualify every year and can only have been done with a special dispensation, which I think was probably to take Russian language training at the school the military runs in Monterey. And in the following year, in 1959, he qualified with a 191. Well, if you're familiar with qualification requirements, that's only 1 point above unsatisfactory, and it was probably, you have to score at least 190 points to qualify, and that was probably a gift from the pits, because when you fire close to qualifying, even if you miss the target and get a Maggie's drawers, which he was reputed to get frequently, which is a white flag wave from the pits when you miss the target completely, he dropped 21 points in 2 years, and there's no telling how bad a marksman he would have been by the year 1963.
Now, didn't they find out also when they recovered the weapon that the scope was way off?
Oh, yes, Tom. The scope was completely misaligned, and the bolt was such a difficult action that it threw off the target. And a lot of folks don't understand that while a scope can enhance accuracy if it's properly aligned, it requires more time to sight in because you got to get those fine hairs located on the target. It's completely ludicrous to suppose that Oswald would have been in that sixth floor and given up the best possible shots as the president was driving toward him on Houston, when his chest and his head were getting larger and larger at a relatively steady speed, and wait until the vehicle turned the corner and he had to shoot through a tree. And yet that's what the Warren Commission would have us believe.
That's a good point.
John, did they say why he wouldn't have shot with the car coming down Houston right at the window, where you would have had the chest and the head all exposed, the face?
Nope.
Because that's the obvious shot if you're a lone gunman. That's the easy one. You get the president fully exposed and coming toward you, and don't have to shoot through any trees or with him moving away. To take the risk of having the president be moving away from you, did they talk about the eyewitness accounts of him being as low as the first floor just minutes before the assassination.
Nothing.
Nothing on that.
No, what's most glaring as I've been listening is just what they didn't say.
Well, that's exactly right, because they are presenting not just selected evidence, but for the most part, false depictions of the evidence. And, I mean, as far as Oswald's location, Tom is right on. One of his co-workers observed him down around the first floor at 11:45, another at 12, another at 12:15. Carolyn Arnold, the secretary to the vice president, observed him there at 12:25 in the lunchroom.
Yep.
And as Tom well delineated, here he's apprehended there within 90 seconds after the assassination by a motorcycle patrolman who holds him in his sights, waits until Roy Truly, a supervisor, comes along to assure him that this is an employee who belongs here. They both, in the reports, which can be found in the Warren report, describing them as acting normal, not perspiring, not agitated, a little bit startled, Roy Truly says, as anyone might be to suddenly find themselves confronted by a police officer with a drone weapon, and he's drinking a Coke.
Yep. I mean, I guess by way of comparison, someone follow Arthur Bremer around just before Wallace was shot. Follow John Hinckley around just before Reagan was shot. If you want to follow lone nuts around, I'd say the most seasoned mob hitman, the guy who is the calmest, coolest cat out there, is not feeling so confident that he can hang out floors below moments before. You remember, no one knows when Kennedy is going to come off Main onto Houston. I mean, if he's just some guy all by himself, that car could come at any time.
Yep.
What's he doing hanging out down below as though he knows exactly when it's coming and can calmly go up to his sniper's nest? I mean, he would be sweating. He'd be there an hour before. He'd be nervous. That alone. But then the other things that trouble me is all the evidence that does point to shots from the knoll. And it seems like there are several things, Professor, that point to shots from the front. When you look at just the Zapruder film, and I know that, Professor, you've done work that shows that that's been doctored with. But when you just look at the headshot, I've always wondered this. Why isn't it that someone who understands, maybe they've been in combat, maybe they're just homicide investigators, why someone can't watch that image of the president's head exploding and say, my God, pretty obvious he got shot from the front? Why isn't that clear just by the way shots hit objects and the way objects move when they're hit?
Oh, you're absolutely right, Tom. I mean, the laws of physics require that shot had to come from the front. I mean, there's been some pseudoscience offered here, the claim that there was something called a jet effect, so that if you're hit from behind, the ejecta is going to force your head in the opposite direction. And they even appealed to a Nobel-winning physicist by the name of Luis Alvarez from Berkeley in support of that. But there is no evidence of the existence of any jet effect. There's a wonderful essay by Ronald White in Assassination Science that details, you know, the problems with appealing to a jet effect. And you're correct. And your common sense argument about people rushing up to the grassy knoll and rushing up to the intersection of the picket fence and the triple underpass are very telling. We have all of that on film. And that is all perfectly legitimate. You had dozens of people rushing up to both of those locations. Yeah. And it makes it completely credible that they believe that shots had been fired from both of those locations.
Yeah, and if you had only one person, well, then maybe you can make an argument. But we have a mass movement here, and one of the things that troubles me is I think common sense has been removed from this assassination study by so many people. Just the average intelligence of people who are at a crime scene to know what's going on. To trust that large numbers of people seeing and hearing the same thing ought to be trusted.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. I have an online journal for advanced research on the death of JFK entitled assassinationresearch.com. And the motto of the journal is, anyone with a sincere interest in this case who does not conclude that John F. Kennedy was killed as the result of a conspiracy is either unfamiliar with the evidence or cognitively impaired. Well, most Americans just don't have time to get familiar with the evidence,
right,
and they tend to depend on the mass media.
Right.
And the problem here was that ABC News of the three major networks has the highest credibility of ABC, NBC, and CBS. NBC comes in higher than that. CNN higher, and PBS higher yet. And individuals who get their information from the print media, from newspapers and magazines, tend to be better informed yet. But those who are dependent primarily on the three national networks turn out to be the least well-informed about what's going on. Those who are principally informed by talk radio, ironically, Tom, and this includes, for example, Rush Limbaugh's audience, tend to be the least well-informed, even though I believe that talk radio is one of our last bastions of freedom of speech and freedom of inquiry, and that programs like this are indispensable to helping Americans to understand what's really going on.
Well, one of the reasons that I was compelled to do this tonight was we are an ABC affiliate, and, you know, this is ABC Radio, and the idea that ABC was part of this was just utterly embarrassing to me as associated with that network. John, I haven't let you get too many questions in here, but did you have anything specifically that gnawed at you from that you wanted to ask the professor?
Well, some of my questions have been answered just as I've been listening,
okay.
but one that hasn't yet was they talked about these audio scientists coming in, and I think that a police officer left his radio on, and they had evidence of at least four shots.
Yes.
That they presented. And it was pretty compelling at the time, but ABC really dismissed that, much like they did the single bullet, you know, drawing a straight line with computer technology. They dismissed it by saying that the officer would have had to be a half a block away. They even had the officer testifying that he was a half a block away from the depository at the time of the shooting, and that his position nullified the evidence that was presented by those scientists. And I didn't understand how that worked. But
well, actually, his position appears to have been very near to the intersection of Houston and Maine. And in fact, there's good reason to think that the acoustical evidence should be taken to be authentic. There's
okay.
It was introduced very late into the House Select Committee's reinvestigation
right.
in 77-78. They found it persuasive at the time. They conducted studies that allowed them to make judgments about whether or not the sounds recorded could have come from the book depository or from the grassy knoll.
Okay.
Now, there actually are half a dozen shooting locations that we believe actually were involved in this case.
Right.
That include the north and the south ends of the Triple Underpass, the Daltex building, and the County Records building, for example. But they conducted studies for just those two locations and discovered confirmation of at least one additional shot from the grassy knoll.
Okay.
Now, in terms of their methodology, it would not have been possible for them to ascertain whether or not they had any sounds that reflected shots from the north or the south end of the Triple Underpass or the top of the County Records building. But interestingly, a reinvestigation of this evidence, which had been discounted by a study in the meanwhile headed by a Harvard physicist who claimed that a sound on the dicta belt of the voice of Sheriff Decker discounted it because his actual statement had only occurred about a minute after the assassination. Well, it appears that's a little fragment of a sentence that has inadvertently appeared on the dicta belt in an odd location where it doesn't belong.
Uh-huh.
Because if you, we're talking about two channels that were if you align what Sheriff Decker said on the left channel with the right channel where it actually occurs a minute later, then of course there's a discrepancy. You're hearing all these sound wave don't get a consistent pattern of four or more shots.
Uh-huh.
But if you assume that voice of Sheriff Decker is inadvertent, the needle skip, for example, because these aren't even the original dicta bells,
uh-huh.
and it's on there inadvertently, there's overwhelming evidence of synchronicity on the sound recording of both channels, and in that case you get a dramatic confirmation that in fact it does record a minimum of six shots, actually as many as seven, eight, or even nine, depending on how you analyze the data. Now,
okay.
The new study of this acoustical evidence appeared in the British Journal Science and Justice in 2001 by a fellow named Donald Thomas. David Mandick, MD, PhD, and I have both taken a look at that, and Thomas's work appears to be good as gold. I had Thomas down to a conference, a national conference in Dallas a couple of years ago, for him to make a presentation when I was co-chairing the conference. And I asked him at the time something I suspected I knew the answer to, namely, was the way the microphones were set up in the vicinity of the sixth floor of the book depository sufficiently discriminating that they could tell whether those three shots that they believed had come from the sixth, the book depository actually had come from there as opposed to, say, the second floor of the Daltex building, from which I believe three shots, in fact, were fired. One that missed and injured a distant bystander, James Tague. Another that missed and hit the chrome strip over the limousine. A third that actually hit Jack in the back of the head after the driver had brought the limousine to a halt in Dealey Plaza. After bullets had begun to be fired. And he said exactly what I thought he would say. The answer was no. It was not sufficiently discriminating to tell whether those three shots had in fact been fired from the book depository or had been fired from the Daltex.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, my belief is that the shots fired from the Daltex were probably the only unsilenced shots that were fired in Dealey Plaza. So you had multiple silenced weapons being used around the plaza that fired as many as 8, 9, or 10 shots, but the only ones you distinctly heard as sounds were these three fired from the unsilenced weapon in the Daltex, plus, and this is fascinating, plus a sound that many witnesses described as different than the others, but came first, the sound of a firecracker. Well, I have a fellow, Jim Lewis, who's been going around firing high-velocity weapons through windshields of junk cars, and guess what? When a high-velocity bullet goes through the windshield, it makes the sound of a firecracker. So that shot that hit Jack in the throat, which went through the windshield, which appears to have been fired from the south end of the triple underpass, created that sound of a firecracker that everyone was wondering, what was that? What was that?
How do they cover up the fact that it went through the windshield?
Well, that was a very neat piece of duplicity. Not only can you see the hole in the windshield in the famous Alchin's photograph where the president's already clutching at his throat, you see in the background the book depository and someone who looks very much like Lee Oswald standing in the doorway. You can see the open window of the Daltex in the background from the very window which was in a closet, a broom closet for a uranium mining operation. There was a CIA front in that building. And you can actually see the door of LBJ's Secret Service vehicle open already, which means they're responding, even though Jack's Secret Service agents are looking around like they're trying to figure out what's going on. As soon as they got the limo to Parkland Hospital, an agent got a bucket and a sponge and started washing the blood and brains out of the limousine. Several motorcycle patrolmen observed this hole in the windshield. A reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Richard Dudman, actually would write about it in a column he published in December. A new witness who was there at the time observed this through-and-through hole, and she was featured in the History Channel, the new segment of The Men Who Killed Kennedy, entitled The Smoking Guns. We have a fellow, Douglas Weldon, who's an attorney from Kalamazoo, who has traced what was done with the limousine. It was taken to the Ford Motor Plant back in Michigan, and by Monday it was already being completely rebuilt. He actually tracked down the fellow who was responsible for replacing the windshield, and he has confirmed that indeed there was a through-and-through hole in the windshield that they replaced. Now,
I got to interrupt here because I was waiting for somebody here to say to me, is this public radio, or don't you guys at some point have to do commercials? Because this is the latest I've ever gone in my 11 years in radio without taking a commercial. It's just significant. It shows how much I think it's important that we get to this stuff. But I have a producer right now who I've never seen look like he looks right now. I've never seen him appear that way. So I have to break. John, thank you so much for your call.
You're
welcome. I'm going to move on. We'll get to some other stuff. Professor Fetzer is here. You bet.
Thanks, Professor.
Professor Fetzer is here until 10 o'clock. We'll get rid of some commercials here and be back. You're listening to KSTP, folks, here in good old St. Paul and big time Minneapolis. You sleep well tonight.
Texas, midday sun.
Mishki Broadcast. Black Sheep Radio, coming to you live from St. Paul, Minnesota. James Fetzer is a distinguished McKnight University professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He has published more articles than I can count, more papers on this assassination. He has been associated with more panels, with more respected assassination researchers coast to coast than I could ever count. He has done a tremendous amount of work over the years trying to bring the truth of this assassination to the public and has been up against all things like what we saw last week with ABC's production of Lone Gunman Theory number 2,326. I don't know how many times we have to face that or why we should still have to face it. I'm fine with people coming up with different theories for what happened in this conspiracy, but I have very little time for people who still believe there wasn't a conspiracy, just because I argue the evidence is overwhelming, and Professor Fetzer has been instrumental in helping bring a lot of that to the public. One question, Professor, that still hasn't been answered is, why does a respected institution like ABC News not provide the other side when they pitch their story on the lone gunman theory?
Well, that's a great question, Tom. I don't think their interest is in being even-handed, because people are prone to forget that the lone gunman scenario is itself a theory, and it's not only a theory, it's one that has been refuted. So it's a false theory that ought to be discarded. I mean, given everything we've already discovered about the magic bullet theory, any account that's based upon it is not defensible, and that includes the Warren Report, the House Select Committee on Assassinations final report, and even Gerald Posner's case closed. In fact, the physician Robert Shaw, who had operated on John Connolly, when told that this bullet, this virtually pristine bullet with only some longitudinal distortion, was allegedly the bullet that had caused all this damage, said he thought that was most unlikely for the simple reason that he had removed more lead from John Connolly's wrist alone than was missing from that bullet.
You bring up another interesting thing. I spoke last hour about the people who were there that day, and if you just listen to them, you'll arrive at a conspiracy just on eyewitness accounts alone. We forget about John and Nellie Connolly, two more people who don't go along with the official story, and they were there.
Nice point, Tom, because John Connolly insisted to his dying day he was hit by a separate bullet. And in fact, if you listen to his account, although in many later versions it has been edited, he said he turned to his right to see what was going on when he realized the president was in distress. He was unable to see anything, so he turned back to his left. And it was only after he turned back to his left that he felt this doubling up in his chest that was the impact of another bullet. Now, when you take into account his turn to the left, it makes it highly probable that wound had to be fired from the side. It could be from the book depository, but it would have to be from the west side, not from the east, where Oswald was alleged to have been located.
Yeah, Connolly was convinced that the president was shot and that he noticed him as shot before any bullet hit him. And what they're arguing is he wouldn't have been able to do that because he would have been shot at the same time by the same bullet. So here you got a guy in the car, another respected individual who should count for something, his wife, who argues the same thing, who is also a witness. And they're just dismissed. And I don't know. Again, I come to a guy like Peter Jennings, and I think, what's in it for him to not pass this stuff along? What does he gain?
Tom, that's such a profound question because, you see, I mean, we have to excise this cancer from the body politic. It sets a bad example. If the government can assassinate the President of the United States in midday in a major American city and cover it up for 40 years, it emboldens them to do any damn thing they want. I mean, you got the Gulf of Tonkin, you got Watergate, you got Iran-Contra. You even have administrations going to war by selling the people false statements major whopping lies about, for example, Saddam Hussein being in cahoots with Osama bin Laden, or Iraq having been involved in 9-1-1, or Iraq having been engaged in acts of terrorism. In fact, our own CIA said that was untrue for the last 10 years. The nation had been grossly weakened by 10 years of bombing after the first Gulf War, when we decimated its military. The idea that Iraq was an imminent threat to the United States was preposterous. And yet that's what the President of the United States and his highest level officials, the Vice President, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, and others all told us.
What do you think is the number one reason why, despite all the investigation being done by people like you, and there are many, many books on this, and you can list the credentials of so many people who are on board with you, respected researchers, scientists, ballistic experts, why do you think... And we have 70% of the American public on board that this was a conspiracy. Why do you think we can't break through that last barrier to making it the accepted story?
Well, to be the accepted story, the government would have to admit to the American people that it had engaged in a deliberate act of deception, that it had lied to the American people.
But it's a different government. Why couldn't they now and say, well, that was those, you know, why wouldn't a Republican administration blame it on a Democratic administration?
Well, it really was much more institutional. It had to do with the Secret Service. We have more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting him up. It has to do with the CIA, the military, and the mafia, because they took him out. It has to do with the FBI, because the FBI covered it up. I mean, J. Edgar and Lyndon Johnson may be gone, and they orchestrated it, but this was done with, or appears to be done with, money from wealthy Texas oilmen. I mean, there are powerful interests that remain. It really was a manifestation of the military-industrial state flexing its muscle, Tom. This was, Peter Dale Scott has written an astounding book called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, where he explains that from the point of view of the military-industrial establishment, which Eisenhower warned us about, taking out Jack was just a minor adjustment to the course of affairs to keep things more or less in constant with the status quo, so that the rich and powerful would remain rich and powerful, and you wouldn't have any redistribution of wealth. Jack had stood up to the oil companies, forced them to take back their increases in prices. He had stood up to the oil boys. He was going to cut their oil depletion allowance. He'd stood up to the CIA. He was threatening to dismantle it. He'd stood up to the mob. Bobby was relentlessly cracking down. He hadn't followed the crackpot recommendations of the Joint Chiefs, who wanted to invade Cuba. I tell you, Jack was taken out. Jack was whacked because he thought he was president of the United States, Tom.
What's amazing when you look at how many enemies he had, powerful enemies. And I would argue it would be hard to find another president surrounded by as many people who hated him, as many powerful people who wanted him gone. And then you think that it just so happened that some nutcase did everybody the favor for him, so they didn't have to bother killing him. There was just some goofy guy named Lee Harvey Oswald, who said, I'll do it for you guys, and just took care of it. And so all the CIA and the FBI and all these guys said, whoa, did we get lucky? What a break. LBJ, who was possibly going to be yanked off the ticket, whoa, what a deal for me. And Hoover, who was going to be possibly pulled as director of the FBI, whoa, did I just catch a break? All these guys just had bonus hour. And if it was one guy, then why not have the cleanest investigation in the history of the United States instead of what is? And everybody agrees on this. There isn't anybody who disagrees that it was the single most botched investigation in the history of homicide investigations. Now, why would you do that if someone just did you the favor of making your career for you?
Tom, you put your finger on a key point. If the government story is true, if this actually was an assassination by a lone, demented gunman, then there is no national security aspect to this case. So why were all the documents and records locked up for 75 years by the Warren Report and then 50 years by the House Select Committee on the basis of national security?
And why'd they burn the notes of the interview with Oswald? And why were people at Dealey Plaza having film confiscated? And why was some guy claiming to be a Secret Service agent keeping people out of the grassy knoll when the Secret Service didn't have anybody there? I mean, why would you have all this stuff that throws this? In fact, what's the guy's name locally here who's been involved quite a bit? Thunheim?
Yes. He was the head of the ARRB, the Assassination Records Review Board.
And he talks about how troubling the secrecy is. Just as an independent investigator into this, he just said it's so troubling, the secrecy, so many secrets. If it's a lone gunman, why have a single secret? Why have one secret?
Hey, since you bring up Thunheim, I'd like to say that I admire the man. I think he's a good man, but he said things that I found troubling. For example, he has said that there were no smoking guns in these new documents that have been released. Well, I've already mentioned one of them, namely that Gerald Ford had that description of the wound changed from the uppermost back to the base of the back of the neck, when in fact the wound to the back was actually 5.5 inches down below the collar. But in the second place, there's confirmation that there were two brain examinations with two different brains. This has come out of the Assassination Records Review Board. See, we've discovered that the autopsy x-rays were patched to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head when he was hit by that frangible bullet from the right front. Tom, it created such force it blew his brains out. They had to patch that up to conceal the shot from in front. And after they patched it up, they had to reconstitute the brain, so they substituted someone else's brain for that of JFK. Now, that's not my finding. That's the finding of a world authority on the human brain, Robert B. Livingston. Now, it turns out the ARRB records, when they released these 60,000 new documents and records, it confirmed that there had been two different brain examinations with two different brains. And get this, it also confirmed that a copy of the film that appears to have been the Zapruder film was brought to the National Photographic Interpretation Center run in Washington by the CIA, and given to the head of the color photo section, Homer McMahon, who was asked to prepare a briefing board for unspecified government officials of the impacts of bullets on the bodies. He watched it at least 10 times to prepare the briefing board and concluded that Jack had been hit 6 to 8 times from at least 3 different directions. Now, when I reflect on it, we have found Jack hit 4 different times, but Big John as many as 3. 4 plus 3 is 7. Tom, which is a number between 6 and 8. So I think Homer is reporting the number of times that individuals in the limousine were impacted by bullets, which was the task he was originally setting out to accomplish. But just notice how stunningly different that is from the present film we have available now. It shows how much it had to be edited, including, of course, to take out the driver bringing the limousine to a halt, for which we have some 60 witnesses.
Right. That's another thing that didn't come up last hour, but that I wanted to say. In that entire parade route, all the way down Maine, down Houston, down Elm, there's only one place that magically the driver of that limousine decides to stop the vehicle, and it happens to be right at the point where just before the shots ring out. It doesn't turn out to be a moving target because the driver flat out stops inexplicably, takes the turn from Houston onto Elm, pulls up ahead, and then stops. Now everybody watching there wondered what the hell was going on. Well, that sure made it easier, and that of course is another part of that stay with the day, stay with the moment, stay with that Dealey Plaza, and you get most of your answers. Another thing I wanted to bring up, you talk about the brain being blown out. Well, just look at again the footage of the head literally exploding and the sheer number of people who had brain on them, from people in the motorcade to people in the car to stuff being found on the street and the curb. I mean, there was brain everywhere. It shouldn't be surprising that there wouldn't have been a brain in his head after that. And yet, again, to see the doctored story, you have this brain intact after everybody was wearing it.
That's right. The brain shown in the national, in diagrams and photographs in the National Archives, because the actual brain itself is missing, is a virtually completely intact brain.
And all these people said they had brain on me, I had brain on my shoulder, brain was all over the car, brain was on the street, on the curb. So, again, sometimes it's best just to stay with the day and with the people who were most able to pass along from being eyewitnesses. Let me take a quick break and come back. We'll run through these calls for Professor Fetzer from the University of Minnesota Duluth. Please stick around. Mischke here for R.F. Moeller Jeweler. This holiday season, if you find yourself thinking of stopping by a jewelry store, R.F. Moeller just asks one thing. Make their jewelry store one of the ones you visit. They realize you're going to shop around, you're going to look and see what everybody else has before you make your decision. Just make sure that either the Gavaday Common Store in downtown Minneapolis, the 50th and France store in Edina, or the flagship store, the St. Paul store at Ford in Cleveland, is one of the places you stop. Talk to the folks there. R.F. Mulder is confident if you just make their store one of the visits, they'll be fine. They'll have a good holiday season. And I'm asking that you do so because I think it's in your own best interest, knowing the Mulder family, knowing their half-century history, knowing what I know about how they do business. R.F. Mulder Jeweler, again, 50th in France, Ford in Cleveland, and Gavaday Common. The ideal jeweler with the ideal diamonds at the ideal prices. R.F. Mulder Jeweler.
Jack Ruby in a capital hat. Whoever taught you to shoot a pistol like that? Well, you snuck in the basement and you stood in the back. Jack Ruby in a capital hat.
Mishki Broadcast, Black Sheep Radio, coming to you live here off the Bleak Barren Tarmac of University Avenue in St. Paul, Minnesota. James Fetzer is with me, a professor from the University of Minnesota Duluth. He has edited a book called Assassination Science. Experts speak out on the death of JFK. You won't find anyone in the country who knows more about this assassination than he does. He joined me at the top of the hour in the 8 o'clock hour, has stayed with me into the 9 o'clock hour. I promised to get through some calls, so I am going to start with Dan. Go ahead, Dan.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I'll take you to task first, Tommy. You know, your theme tonight has been stay with the day. And so if you think about people when they're emotionally charged, their adrenaline's pumping, they're waiting for the president, they all loved him, I'd have to say those are the most inconsistent and unreliable witnesses, especially if they hear shots ring out or firecrackers or whatever they hear. All of a sudden, I think you have to throw out 99.9% of their observations.
But just think about what you're saying. If that was how we operated with criminal investigations, removing eyewitness accounts, because when shots ring out and there's a big crime and a traumatic situation, folks are unreliable. We shouldn't investigate any crimes with eyewitnesses, when in fact, typically in this country, they're how we do solve crimes. So you'd like to take the entire judicial system and turn it on its ear, which is another argument, but that's what you're going to have to argue if you're going to go down the road you're going down, Dan.
No, but I think, you know,
I was
here in the Twin Cities when Gorbachev was here, and people were literally weeping when they saw him. You know, it's an emotionally charged situation.
What does that mean, though? Because they were weeping, they maybe didn't see that his car was driving by, or they didn't see the kind of day it was, that it was cold in June.
I think they all have a different personal, at that point, attachment, and it keeps them from being
rational
as they could be.
I bet everybody can tell you what he was driving in. I bet you everybody can tell you what the weather was. I bet you everybody can tell you what street they were on when the car came down. I bet there are a million reliable things you can get from those people, along with them being emotional. You seem to argue that if emotion enters, then all logic goes out the window, and I don't know where you get that.
Well, I've also deer hunted all my life in big parties, small parties, and when you have a plan and you make a drive, and let's say you kick a big buck out and everybody takes a shot, and at the end one guy says, you know, I got it, and I shot him through the head, and you go over and you check the deer and somebody shot him in the butt instead. You know, everybody at that point, they can't even tell you how many shots were fired, much less who.
Then let me ask you this. Then if we're going to throw out the eyewitnesses, what are we going to use to investigate this crime, Dan? What are we going to use? You're a cop. We're tossing out eyewitness accounts. You're in Dealey Plaza, 11-22-03. What are you using? Don't talk to anybody because those are eyewitnesses. What are you using?
I would just discount.
What are you using? Don't tell me what you're discounting. Don't tell me what you're discounting. Tell me what you're counting. What counts on that day? Give me something.
From the crowd, nothing.
Hey, Dan.
Because
Dan, you're not answering my question. Dan, you are not answering my question. I'm going to ask it one more time. So what counts in terms of investigating this? Give me one thing that counts. Anything, please.
If you grab the vehicle and grab the scientific evidence, but the problem is, like, they presented on ABC and on PBS. I was pretty convinced by that little computer graphic. Now, if that was generated and it's all falsehood, how does a guy like me know?
Well, that's why Tom is having me on, to help to explain that it was based upon false assumptions and unreliable data. And your argument, by the way, wouldn't carry over to Oswald's co-workers who saw him in and around the lunchroom or the first floor at a quarter at 12, at 12, at 12:15, at 12:25. There was nothing emotionally laden about that. Besides, studies have shown that eyewitnesses are highly reliable about relatively simple events they observe. The car being brought to a halt is not something that's a complicated phenomenon. Roy Truly, for example, Oswald's supervisor who was in front, was very explicit about it. He said the driver swung too far out when he turned from Houston onto Elm, nearly hit a concrete abutment, and almost had to bring the car to a halt right there. That's directly below the snipers, alleged snipers there. If Oswald had been there, it would have been irresistible, I think. Plus, he said he had to drive back to get more or less online, and then after bullets began to be fired, he pulled to the left and he halted. And there are 59 other corroborating witnesses who report the same thing.
Then I think you're definitely onto something, if that is indeed true. Now, I'm not a student of this, and so, you know, you have been. And
let me tell you where you can go, because I'm
people
to
read
know
that
where
book,
the evidence
Deep
is,
Politics,
okay? Because Tom mentioned the first book. Now, these are collections of studies by experts. I bring the best people on different aspects of the case together, and that was Assassination Science. There you can find the evidence about the fabrication of the x-rays, about the brain being substituted for another brain, and preliminary studies about the film itself being faked. The second book, Murder in Dealey Plaza, includes reports about the 59 witnesses on Elm Street who saw the limousine either slow dramatically or come to a complete halt. In a more recent book, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, I include the reports of witnesses who have actually seen the more complete film, who confirmed that the driver turned too widely as he turned from Houston onto Elm, and that he pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt, and that Jack was hit twice after the limousine was brought to a halt, and that the driver only accelerated after the president had his brains blown out, even though he testified falsely that he had accelerated after Connolly had been hit. That was all rubbish.
And I would say that the doctors at the hospital would not fall into your category of being too emotional. The doctors who see the wounds and call them entrance wounds and report on that day that they're looking at frontal shots, there's no reason to say they're just too emotional to know an entrance wound from an exit wound. Nor would I say a police officer, a trained police officer in Dallas, who's probably used to the sound of gunshots and is running towards the grassy knoll, gun drawn, that would be an emotional response.
Let me make a suggestion for Dan, okay? If you go to my website, assassinationscience.com, you'll find a critique I have written, ABC Simulation, Spectacular Disinformation. It's the first item on my website. Just go and read that through and see if that makes any sense, because it just reveals the vast amount of evidence we have to show that magic bullet theory is hopelessly false.
What's the website?
It's assassinationscience.com.
Okay.
Tom.
Okay.
And there's several other brain teasers there. You know, before I went on Jesse's show, the producer and I were talking. They wanted to show the Zapruder film, but they learned that the sixth floor was going to charge them $70,000 to show the film. Well, I got news for you. You can save $70,000 by going to my website, because we have a new Zapruder film that's complete and better than anything ever before available, and it's free and available to the public on my website.
$70,000?
Well, $70,000 just to show it, Tom, and you've got the whole damn thing in a better version, scientifically improved over any version previously available, more complete. Most people don't know that the MPI version, which is claimed to be the best available version, is missing frames 155 and 156, does not include frames 208, 209, 210, 211, has frames 331 and 332 reversed, and doesn't even include frames 341, 350, or even 486, which is the last frame. This version has all of those frames and has it technically enhanced, so it looks more like it should have looked, and it doesn't suffer from various kinds of distortion as a function of the lens. You ought to go there. You can see it, have it available to you forever
on
my website.
Assassinationscience.com. Go ahead, Dan, with your last question.
I just am curious, who do you think is behind the current propaganda of, you know, ABC, PBS, and this information?
corporations, Dan, I'm sorry to say, corporations. This is a government of, by, and for corporations. Mussolini, interestingly, said that fascism could be defined as corporatism because it really was a government. Fascism was a government of, by, and for corporations where the people are treated as consumers. You and I'm afraid, only count in relation to our net worth, how many products we can buy. That's what they want from us. They want a docile population.
And why would a corporation gain by the lone gunman theory? I don't get it.
They don't want to rock the boat, Tom. They don't want if the people realize how much the government has lied to them in the past, they're going to start distrusting the government on every ground. I think we have a lot of reason now because this administration has been so blatant in its forms of deception. But really, it's a matter of the American people becoming more critical and starting to think about what's going on. I mean, I can show you example after example. For example, one of these programs on ABC was featured Robert Oswald, the brother of Lee, and said he just wanted to be somebody. So he killed the president because he just wanted to be somebody. But if he just wanted to be somebody, why did he deny that he was the shooter? I mean, he can't be somebody if he's just a patsy. Then he's a nobody who was taken advantage
right,
of.
Right. Right. Dan, I got to go. Thank you. I appreciate your call. I want to get to another caller here while I can. Go ahead, Bud.
Yeah, hi, guys. I'm always fascinated by this discussions, but the History Channel had some wonderful programming that Dan maybe should have watched.
Now, the History Channel is a good example of a credible organization. They've done some great stuff, and they infuriated the LBJ family, infuriated them with their piece they did last week implicating LBJ in the assassination. And a lot of people were saying, what's with the History Channel, reputable organization like that, doing a piece on... They were asking my question in reverse, which is, what's a good organization like that doing with the...
I did have a question in regards to specifics about something I seen there that I hadn't seen before, and it's about the gunman, one of the gunmen's taking route through the sewers. Now, it seemed this could have been the shot through his head. They had a very plausible looking, I'm sure your guest must. Are you aware of that theory about a guy sitting in the sewer and getting away through the sewers?
Professor? Did he go? Did we lose him? Oh, well, call him back, see what happened there.
Well, I hope they didn't get him. Did they get him?
Yeah. No, when I hung up on Dan, he was still on, so I don't know. Maybe his cell phone went or something, but we'll try and get him back.
Shoot. But did you see that theory, Tom?
I did not see the History Channel piece. In fact, I am aware.
Yeah, no, you don't have KO. You got to get the copies of it at least and watch them.
I've read quite a few books on it, and I know. And you know, the thing that I do, which is different than Professor Fetzer, all I say is that we move beyond one guy. That's all I say.
As soon as
we go beyond one guy, then let's open the whole thing up again. I don't have more theories
Professor
than
Fetzer's
that.
Professor Fetzer's getting a little too political with it, but he's definitely on to that. It's definitely a conspiracy. But there was this fascinating people that they. There was one guy that worked, that was in the military, that they were training to be assassins, and he had on his list that he was supposed to only kill people out of the country, and then he was told that this certain general he was going to have to go kill, and sure enough, the general ended up dead, but he didn't do it.
Let me ask the professor what he knows about shots from a sewer.
Well, there's an ambiguity about the use of the word sewer here, Tom. Some people think that by the sewer they mean this curbside sewer opening. Actually, David Mantic and I have been in that sewer opening. He actually got in it to check out the trajectory there, and we do not believe any shots were fired from there. On the other hand, the north and the south end of the triple underpass, there were above-ground sewer openings there where a man could stand with a little camouflage and have an ideal shooting location, and in fact, we believe that the shot to the throat was fired from the south end of that structure, the shot that went through the windshield and hit the man in the throat, and then the shot to the right temple was actually fired from the north end of that structure. But get this now, we believe that, in fact, the limousine was about 30 feet further down the street than it's shown in the Zapruder film. In other words, it was just about opposite the steps, those concrete steps that go up toward the grassy knoll when that shot to the right temple was fired.
Now, wasn't there someone who... Another eyewitness, if we're gonna count our eyewitnesses, who heard a shot whistling by his ear?
Yeah, well, even Abraham Zapruder said there was a shot from behind him. Gordon Arnold, who was a trained infantry man, said that a shot was fired from behind him, and that would have been a shot from... It could have been the shot from the intersection of the Triple Underpass and the Grassy Knoll, just as the shot Zapruder heard could have been then from the Grassy Knoll itself. A lot of people said that. But Kenny Powers and Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers, who were riding in the Secret Service limousine behind Jack, said bullets were whizzing all over the place. They told that to Tip O'Neill during a dinner, and he wrote about it in the book, The Man of the House, about his period as Speaker of the House. He was very upset and nailed them on it. He said, well, that's not what you tell the Warren Commission. And they admitted rather sheepishly, well, the family wanted to get it behind them, so they told the FBI what they wanted to hear.
And that is, by the way, that is one thing that I do understand. I don't agree with it, but I do understand, and that is... If you are not involved at all in the assassination, if you're not complicit in this thing, and you just have a belief that if the United States, if Americans think that there is this great conspiracy involving different aspects of the government, if they think that's true, you might have chaos or anarchy on your hand. I can see someone arguing, you know, the president's dead. If we let the true story out, we're not going to have a country anymore. Even though I wouldn't agree with that, because I think the truth is always best in these instances, I can see someone going along, either an Earl Warren or someone else or a Gerald Ford, is saying, you know, I don't like it, but what will our country be if they believe there's been a coup?
Yeah, well, that's, yes, well, Lyndon used the kind of argument that there might be a world war with 30 or 40 million dead in order to induce Earl Warren to accept a position he should never have had, because after all, suppose the Warren Commission had actually done its job and come up with some suspects, this would have led to criminal trials, no doubt. They would have eventually wound up before the Supreme Court, whose Chief Justice, however, had already been compromised by participating in the initial inquiry. He was strong-armed by Lyndon. Lyndon had a great way of discerning individuals' weaknesses. He knew how to manipulate them. He was a master manipulator. Today, these techniques of propaganda, you know, the big lie, are being used on an astonishingly large scale. That's what disturbed you in the beginning here, Tom. That's what disturbs me. I mean, when a powerful entity like ABC News put complete and utter unadulterated nonsense, and I'm using, you know, being very generous in my depiction here. I mean, the film itself they were basing upon is, you know, it really not a reliable, it's been completely remanufactured. We have all kinds of evidence that the film has been changed. Even John Connolly's left turn was omitted from it. The driver looking back at Jack happens much too fast. Too fast to even be humanly possible. All the brains on the trunk has all been cleaned and tidied up. Secret Service agents admitted they got sick from seeing the brains on the truck. Abraham Zapruder's assistant, Erwin Schwartz, said he saw the brains blown out to the left and to the rear. He saw them blown out to the left and to the rear. We have, you know, multiple witnesses to what happened here.
Well, even Jackie Kennedy, I believe, was said to be trying to collect brain from the
Jackie
trunk.
Jackie climbs out on the back of the trunk. She's going after a chunk of Jack's brain and skull.
Right.
She's trying to hold the back of his head together. She testifies to the Warren Commission that, you know, from the front, Jack looked just fine. Well, he wouldn't have looked just fine if there'd been a high-velocity bullet that had gone through the back of his head and out the right front of his head.
Right, it would have blown out the front of his head.
That bulging out of brains on the film appears to have been painted in, which was the conclusion of Roderick Ryan, an expert from Hollywood, who actually won an Academy Award for his contribution to cinematography. Even the blood spray turns out to have been an add-on. It appears to have been done a kind of a painting on glass. When you use an optical printer, Tom, it turns out you can add any foreground, put together any foreground with any background, and you could add any special effects you want to produce a whole new film on a whole new strip of celluloid. And that's what was done here.
I'm going to take another caller here. Roger.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It doesn't look anything like this. They go, no.
Roger.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I was talking about the storm drain, just like that other guy was. When the guy used that metallurgical background, he used to work for U.S. Steel.
We're talking about Tom Wilson?
Yes. And I tell you what, he's got it pegged right down to the foot.
Look, I like Tom Wilson. He's a good guy. He's now deceased, of course.
Yeah.
And Tom Wilson made a lot of contributions, but we do not believe that his reconstruction, as far as that shot is concerned, is correct. Now, have you been down in that sewer?
No, I haven't. But
well,
boy, I tell
David,
you
and I, David and I have. I'm just telling you, it doesn't work. Now, I can understand why some people think it does, and I'm glad that Tom's work is out there and immortalized in The Men Who Killed Kennedy. But, you know, our reconstruction doesn't include that shot.
You know, the thing that I just wish would happen, you know, we could have guys call all night long with different theories of what this conspiracy involves. But if you just got the right people in the country to just accept conspiracy, we could have this thing reopened again. Just that little step, and there always has seemed to be enough evidence for that. But
Tom, let me pick up on this, because you're really on the verge of something tremendously important. But during the history of this case, most people have thought conspiracy meant how many shooters. Was there more than one shooter? And they fixated on that. But you have to realize Texas oilmen could have hired a half a dozen shooters to take out Jack, and it would have implicated the government. You have to consider the alteration of the evidence, the patching of the X-ray, the substitution of the brain, implicating Oswald on the basis of phony evidence, the alteration, the fabrication of the Zapruder film. These are the indications that point in a higher direction, because the brain, for example, was under control of naval officer, Secret Service, and the president's personal physician. There's no way the mafia, for example, could have done it. Poor anti-Castro Cubans couldn't have got their, you know, substituted a brain for the brain of someone else. The KGB might have had the technical ability, like our own CIA, to alter a film, but they couldn't have got their hands on the Zapruder film, nor could any of these things have been done by Lee Oswald, who was either incarcerated or already dead. You aren't left with a whole lot of alternatives.
We have a positively bizarre scene going on at the autopsy, perhaps the single strangest scene for an autopsy where the information gleaned is so critical. Talk about what goes on at the autopsy that we know for a fact in terms of who's running it and dictating what occurs.
Well, in the first place, the choice of Bethesda Naval Hospital appears to have been dictated by the fact that Jack, as a former naval officer, had his medical records there. So that if you needed, an X-ray of Jack, for example, the shot to the throat had to have caused some structural damage. But they made a substitution of an earlier chest X-ray. So there, you can't do better than have an authentic chest X-ray of Jack Kennedy, because anyone who tests its authenticity will determine that is indeed authentic. One of the most stunning events that took place during this autopsy, and the president's body, interestingly, at Parkland, was put into a very large bronze ceremonial casket. I was on with Aubrey Reich, who actually placed the body in that large ceremonial casket on Jesse's show. It was a very substantial, heavy casket. But the body was brought into Bethesda Naval Hospital in a black Navy ambulance in a pinkish-gray shipping casket, and it was in a body bag. Now, they began the autopsy, and Gerald Custer, who was responsible for taking the X-rays, was on his way upstairs in the company of Secret Service agents when he noticed the formal entourage arriving with that big bronze casket in a gray Navy hearse. He saw Jackie and Robert McNamara walking into the building, and he was completely perplexed because he had in his hands X-rays of the president that were already exposed, and he was taking them upstairs to develop them. The autopsy was already going on.
Who was the guy in the autopsy who was sort of telling people what to do? There was a general there or something, wasn't there?
Well, this general was the commanding officer of the Military District of Columbia, but there were other high-ranking officers. Custer and others have told me there was a general, a high-ranking officer there. They thought four stars, who was smoking a cigar. There's a name on the list of those who were present at the autopsy that says General Curtis. Everyone's wondered who General Curtis was. I'm convinced it was General Curtis LeMay, whose first name was the only name given when he went in there. You're not supposed to smoke cigars, but the one guy in the world who would be doing that would be LeMay. Plus these guys, and I've talked with Jim Jenkins, I've talked with Paul O'Connor, I've talked with Dennis David, as well as Gerald Custer. They all said, oddly enough, that after the autopsy, that there was a festive activity, a festive atmosphere among all these military officers who were there, that when they first came in, they all were apprehensive, like they thought Jack Kennedy was going to sit bolt upright, that he wasn't actually dead. But as it proceeded, that they more and more seemed to relax and become very congenial, even convivial in their attitude. Rather striking, unless you realize that, in fact, the Joint Chiefs appear to have been involved, that they at this point considered Jack Kennedy to be the biggest obstacle to international international communism, that he had not invaded Cuba against their unanimous recommendation, that he had gone ahead and signed an above-ground test ban treaty against the unanimous opposition. Now he is pulling all our forces out of Cuba. If you read James Bamford's Body of Secrets, you'll see the chiefs had become paranoid at this point in time, and taking Jack out was something they may have considered to be essential.
When do you think, and this will be my last question of the evening, do you think in your lifetime, as a nation, we'll have the final story on this and have it be an accepted one, or are we a century away?
Well, the most reliable in this evidence in this case, Tom, is the hard evidence. It's evidence about the x-rays. It's evidence about the autopsy report. It's evidence about the autopsy photographs. It's evidence about the brain. It's evidence about the film. We have gone into this in spades, and we've discovered all of this most basic evidence has been faked or fabricated or phonied up one way or another. The entire case is built on a house of cards, and if it didn't have the government propping it up, if anyone were just to look at the evidence that we've laid out, for example, in the prologue to Murder in Dealey Plaza, or in the prologue to the Great Zapruder film hoax, go to a store and just read the prologue. Go to my website and just read about the books. Go to Amazon.com and just read about the books.
Okay, how about this, though? How about this? Say we get a Jesse Ventura-type guy as president of the United States, a guy who's fascinated by the Kennedy assassination and wants it reopened. Maybe that's all it takes.
All it takes would be for the government to do something the government has not shown an inclination to do. Tell the truth to the American people. The truth is there. The truth is devastating, but we need to know it. I mean, this is one of the problems with secret government operations, and this administration has been more secretive than any other. It's like the CIA. If the CIA is conducting covert operations in secret, the American people aren't allowed to know. How do we, as the American people, even know if we support our nation's own foreign policy if we're not allowed to know what that foreign policy is? It's a dilemma for democracy. We got to get over it. Secrecy is antithetical to a democratic government. As long as we are ignorant, we cannot be free.
And on that note, Professor Fetzer, I want to thank you not only for your work on this and the 2 hours you gave me tonight, but for making yourself available on short notice after everything that occurred over the last few days and the weekend. I just wanted to do something that addressed what I thought was a very strange week in terms of a nation coming to terms with an assassination of a president and a lot being clouded rather than cleared up at a time in 2003 where we really have enough information to clear things up. So I want to thank you for helping clear up this story tonight on the air, and hopefully I'll be in touch with you again. Good to talk with you as always.
You're very perceptive, Tom. I'm very glad to be on with you. I'll do it any time.
All right. Good night to you. Bye-bye. That's Professor James Fetzer, University of Minnesota, Duluth. Mischke here for the Spectacle Shop, located off Silver Lake Road in New Brighton. A lot of people saying, don't know where New Brighton is. People in New Brighton are a little miffed to hear that. Some folks saying, I don't ever get out of St. Paul. I'm with you, brothers and sisters, I don't either. But one thing I learned recently was, when there's a one-of-a-kind shop, and you're only going to buy something once in 2-3 years, like a pair of glasses, well, might be worth it. You get out there and you realize this literally is a one-of-a-kind shop. You've never seen a shop like this, never been in a shop like this, never seen a selection like this. Couldn't have. Won't find one in the five-state area. Forget the Twin Cities, the five-state area. Won't find anyone like Dave Ulrich out there. Won't find a guy who collects glasses and has them from the 1200s and Buddy Holly glasses and Elvis glasses and can tell you what everybody in the entire world wears for glasses and what every king and queen has on and has his own line of glasses that he designed himself and has the most beautiful store Hollywood producers want to shoot films in it. It's a very amazing experience. So if you need glasses, the Spectacle Shop off Silver Lake Road in New Brighton. Well, by gum and by golly, that's a show. I want to thank Nancy Fox for not doing the news at the bottom of the hour. Because, unfortunately, along with a few other things, we blew off her news. And hopefully she's not too upset out there. I'll find out when I leave the studio. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to Professor Fetzer and the good work he does. Keep reading. KSTP, good old St. Paul, big time, Minneapolis.
From ABC News.
And sleep well.
I'm Paul James.